Riots in Baltimore, just 40 miles from the White House, represent another challenge for the Obama administration as it faces racial unrest across the country. Is this a turning point? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday. We'll start by having this week's analysts, Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, give us their thoughts on events in Baltimore. Also, might Republican presidential candidates actually cheer a pro-gay marriage ruling by the Supreme Court? And the role of Iowa evangelicals in the Iowa caucuses. What are your thoughts on the riots in Baltimore? Is it a turning point? Join our discussion. First, this news. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Joining us this hour, Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa in our Iowa City studio. Tim Hagel, welcome to the program again.
Hey there.
Donna Hoffman is with us in our Cedar Falls studio, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Donna, great to have you back as well.
Hi, Ben. Hi, Tim.
And we want to address a number of things. As always, we look at the political landscape over the last few days to see what pops out and get some analysis and thoughts on it. And we also want to invite you to join our discussion this hour. First and foremost, we're going to tackle the events, the unrest, the riots in Baltimore. Join our discussion with the questions this raises in your mind. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Well, so we heard in the top of the hour news, the streets of Baltimore were for the most part quiet overnight. Some scattered arrests were reported during a curfew imposed after this latest wave of rioting, some rioting fueled by anger against U.S. police killings of black men, growing violence in Baltimore. Just 40 miles from the White House is representing another challenge for the Obama administration as it addresses racial unrest across the country. Since the police killing of an unarmed teenager in Ferguson, Missouri, that was last summer, the administration has worked to acknowledge deep frustrations in minority communities while also supporting law enforcement. Yesterday, President Obama commented on the riots in Baltimore, saying the violence is counterproductive and unacceptable, and urged Americans to do some soul searching.
I think there are police departments that have to do some soul searching. I think there's some communities that have to do some soul searching. But I think we as a country have to do some soul searching. But if we really want to solve the problem, if our society really wanted to solve the problem, we could. It's just it would require everybody saying this is important, this is significant. And that we don't just pay attention to these communities when a CVS burns. And we don't just pay attention when a young man gets shot.
President Obama yesterday, in response to the riots as well in Baltimore, Iowa Senator Charles Grassley, who is chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, says he's considering calling on U.S. Justice Department to review all cases where minorities die at the hands of police.
We're in the early stages of looking at what the committee can or should do. Perhaps it's a hearing, perhaps it could be legislation, or it could be nothing. We just don't know yet. I think we need to be very judicious in any response.
Okay, what are your thoughts, River to River listeners? What questions does this raise in your mind? Is it perhaps a turning point of some sort? 1-866-780-9100, River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Tim Hagel, your observation says you've watched this over the last few days in terms of your political view of these riots.
Boy, that kind of wide open kind of question there. There's just so many things going on, and it's not the kind of a thing that there's a simple solution. If there were, we probably would have found it already, or at least somebody would have suggested it. And it's not simply as a few people have said, investing more in infrastructure or paying more attention, because people have been paying attention to the problem, and especially in Baltimore, that there have been people that have been paying attention to the problem. But it's a complex problem. There are many different aspects to it. It's not just about the police. It's not just about the community or parenting. It's just a wide combination of things, and it's hard to really untangle that knot.
Mm-hmm. Do you see this, Donna, as a continuation, something that happened for the first time in Ferguson? Why is this happening now, and are we going to see some sort of significant change because of this?
Well, you know, that's kind of a difficult question, but, you know, if you look at American history, we had urban riots in the 60s, and they went on for a number of years. We had the LA riots in the 90s. All of those at some level kind of stem from the same issue that these protests are stemming from in many of these inner city locations, with Ferguson, with Baltimore. And so is it a turning point? You know, that's, again, difficult to answer, but it certainly is an issue that people are paying more attention to, and the media coverage of it is forcing the public to see things, public that, you know, perhaps doesn't live in inner city environments, causing them to think about the issue. Certainly presidential candidates are having to think about the issue and to talk about it as well. And so whether it will be a turning point or not, I think is, again, a difficult question. But, you know, one of the things, and going back to what Senator Grassley said in the clip that you played, one of the things that, you know, could portend a change is that you do have new leadership in the Justice Department. And so Loretta Lynch was sworn in at the beginning of the week. This is the first issue really that's on her plate, more or less, that was thrust there. And we'll see how she, you know, handles that. But also one has to balance, as Tim was talking about, these are complicated issues. These are local issues that are wound up in this. These are local police forces that are in the trenches every day, and local communities that have long histories in terms of their relationship with the community and the police. And so you can have different dynamics in these different cities as well. But, you know, at its crux, these start out as local issues, not mm-hmm. federal issues that federal policymakers can always address and do so very quickly.
Mm-hmm. We definitely want to talk about the reaction of the 2016 candidates, declared and hopeful candidates. But what about President Obama's performance here, Tim Hagel? He is an African American president. We think back to his campaigns and people saying this was the end of marked a new turning point in racial relations in the United States, and now we're seeing some unrest that we haven't seen for many years.
Yeah, it's kind of an odd thing that there didn't seem to be sort of that healing that maybe some people were expecting, or maybe it was a matter of that this is now brought to the fore because of President Obama. It's hard to say. But in terms of his actual speech, that it got, not surprisingly, mixed reactions. So some people were very pleased that he came out with a strong statement saying, look, if you know, set a store on fire, that's not a protest, that's arson. If you loot a store, that's not a protest, that's theft. And those are good, strong statements saying, look, if you want to protest, protest, but do it in a peaceful way. But then when he drifted into the clip that you played with the soul searching kind of a thing, that's where he lost a number of people, especially on the right, saying, look, it's not a matter of soul searching. And to a certain extent, and this kind of goes back to what Don was just saying, where these are local issues and a local dynamic. And it's particularly in Baltimore where you have a black power structure politically, that these are things that if they wanted to address them, they really could have. Let me just also chime in, too, in terms of Loretta Lynch being the new Attorney General. I'm not sure that she's really going to have much of an opportunity to do anything. As a new person, she's got to come in and as a former attorney for the United States attorney, that she's certainly got some experience with the Justice Department, but all of a sudden when you're thrust into the top position, that it's going to take a while to get yourself settled into that position. So how much she's going to be able to do, particularly in the time that she's got left in the Obama administration, it's probably not likely anything major.
Mm-hmm. Donna Hoffman, also the president saying in the clip we played a little bit of a, I don't know, not a resignation, I wouldn't go that far, but saying, listen, it's up to you whether Americans, whether this fades from our headlines or whether something is done about it? Is that the way you heard that too, Donna?
A little bit, but, you know, more a reflection of the fact that these are complex issues. They're some people see them as rather intractable. And a president sitting where he does in terms of the federal governmental structure cannot, you know, nobody in the federal government can wave a magic wand and fix these. Can't be Loretta Lynch, can't be Obama. So what he's really, I think, appealing for is kind of a bottom-down approach, this notion of self-reflection, a bottom-down approach in which communities try to deal with these issues at the local level in terms of how police forces interact with the people that they are trying to keep safe and whether that's been working in the past and whether it hasn't. And again, we have a long history in this country of problems in this particular area that go back for decades.
Mm-hmm. 2016 presidential candidates reacting to this news. They will be reacting to everything that is a major on the landscape in domestic politics, also foreign politics, I suppose. Hillary Clinton there speaking, I guess, this morning at Columbia University, talking about our criminal justice system being out of balance, also calling for body cameras. Tim Hagel, do you see Hillary Clinton as a different candidate when she's out there? This is the first policy speech that she's given. I guess also thinking about a candidate wanting to stay ahead of these issues, having to have a firm statement about unexpected occurrences like this?
Well, without having heard the full speech and just sort of phrases like out of balance, I mean, that's really not saying a whole lot. I mean, you can say, okay, it's out of balance. Well, what are you going to do about it? That's the key. And if she's talking about balance in terms of, as people often do, racial disparities in the number of people that are in prison or the fact that you have, and I think she used the phrase in a tweet, mass incarceration, well, that just gets at the total number of people. And oddly enough, I was just telling my criminal justice class yesterday, the number of people that are incarcerated is around 1.6 million, and then another 800,000 or so that are in jails for less than a year. So that's a pretty significant number. You see that number a lot. The question is, well, what are you going to do about it? It's a matter of the war on drugs, and there's some aspect of that in the news. If we cut down the number of people that are they're supposedly just users or nonviolent criminals and find some alternatives, then you reduce the number of the people in prison, which then perhaps can increase the family structure because that feeds into this as well. You don't have these fathers that are absentee because they're away in prison or jail or something like that. So again, this is where you start to get into a variety of problems. And for somebody to say, oh, it's out of balance or you have to deal with this problem, okay, but how are you going to deal with it and still also maintain respect for law and order and not have crime rates rise and so forth? And so if you try to fix one problem, all of a sudden you're exacerbating another problem.
Mm-hmm. What are you hearing from presidential contenders, Donna Hoffman, that captures your attention on this issue?
Well, one of the things that Hillary Clinton said in the speech, and I didn't get to see or hear the whole speech, but I saw some snippets of it. But one of the things she said was, I think, captures this kind of balancing act that the candidates all have to do in terms of how they, as you put it, I think, get ahead of these issues because they want to show that they are responsive and they want to also at least try to demonstrate that they have the experience to deal with these issues. So one of the things that Hillary Clinton said in relation to her criminal justice reform was that we need to have an approach that would would offer respect for the law and then when everyone in the community is respected by the law. So she's talking about both the problems that you have within communities that feel marginalized and where we have these cases of police misconduct, but also respect for the law. And that's what you get out of presidential candidates typically, is this balancing act at this stage of the game in which they look at these issues oftentimes, in really kind of short period of time, may not have as much reflection as they want to have, and they try to balance the way that they approach these issues. And so that's typically what you see. Interestingly enough, Martin O'Malley, who's oftentimes forgotten about but seems to be running for the Democratic nomination also, was and has been in Iowa quite a bit but hasn't gotten a lot of traction, was mayor of Baltimore and was governor of Maryland. And he, cut short some of his activities to return to Maryland. And, this is a difficult issue for him if he's going to go forward with the presidential race, because he had a policy in Baltimore when he was mayor there that actually was seen as being significant in terms of cutting down on the amount of crime in that city. but it also has apparently had an economic impact as well, because minor offenses like loitering and things were things that people were being arrested for, that then it might be difficult to get expunged from your record. And so if you're applying for a job and you have an arrest record, then you may not get that job. And so there's things that people try to do, policymakers try to do, all well-intentioned, that can have unintended consequences. And, you know, that's kind of the history of this area as well.
Yeah, and I was actually talking with Ben about that a little bit before the show started, mentioning just exactly what you were saying. And the problem that O'Malley faces, this could be a good thing and could be a bad thing for him in terms of his, if he has any presidential campaign aspirations. And that because of some of the people that were interviewed during the riots were suggesting that the crackdown on crime maybe reduced the crime rate, but it had these effects that that Donna was talking about in terms of the people in particular, more generally the economic situation. So that's seen as both a good and a bad thing, and how O'Malley handles it at this point, that this could be an important moment for him if he really does have any plan to enter the presidential race.
And I would add to that, Hillary Clinton has a similar issue in that some of the get tough criminal justice policies were implemented in the 90s in her husband's administration, and again have been seen as significant in terms of cutting down on crime, but has also in some ways, and some policies going forward in the 2000s as well, contributed to the militarization of police forces. And again, so good intentions, but sometimes unintended consequences that you can't always foresee as those policies are being implemented.
Donna Hoffman is with us of the University of Northern Iowa. Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa. Politics Wednesday here on River to River. You can join our discussion 1-866-780-9100. Yesterday, we heard that the justices of the U.S. Supreme Court, they sparred, they probed these legal arguments on same-sex marriage. No certainty about the outcome. We won't know that until the summer. And we did have, though, an indication from we heard this morning in NPR's reporting by Nina Totenberg, the justices seem deeply divided. Justice Anthony Kennedy, considered to be a swing vote, questioned whether the court has the authority to change the definition of marriage.
The word that keeps coming back to me in this case is millennia. This definition has been with us for millennia. And it's very difficult for the court to say, oh, well, we know better.
Okay, Tim Hagel, you have the legal background here in addition to your political background. What do you see? Do you have any predictions for how the court will rule here?
I'm going to stay away from the predictions things, but I can tell you that at least as far as what we heard in that, just heard in that clip, and as I tell my students on a regular basis, in fact, I was telling them this just yesterday again, hitting my class is really good here today, Ben, that, you know, it doesn't really matter what anybody does, how many states are doing one thing or another thing. The court can do whatever it wants to do. If it finds it through a phrase that at least the conservatives on the court really do not like, but is often used by a number of people, including Justice Kennedy, evolving standards of decency. And so despite the idea that marriage may have been defined by millennia in one particular way, if all of a sudden they are now reading the Constitution through either the Equal Protection Clause or the Due Process Clause as being read another way based on current rights, evolving standards of rights, if you want to phrase it that way, they can do that. That's basically what their job is.
But it doesn't mean it will settle a national debate. We had a ruling Roe v. Wade in 1973, and that has festered on in this country for a long time.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, it's funny because I saw some graph that somebody had put together in terms of how things had changed on this. And with the Roe versus Wade thing, they sort of had that on the abortion issue. They had the graph end at Roe versus Wade as if that somehow settled the issue, which, of course, it certainly hasn't done. And we're still arguing it, as you say, 40 plus years later. So what it settles sometimes is at least certain a portion of the law. But even as far as the law is concerned, if the court were to recognize or force a state to recognize a same-sex marriage that was performed in another state, that's basically the idea in this one of these cases that was before the court, that's not going to settle a variety of tangential issues. And that's what we're seeing with basically the whole same-sex marriage when you're getting to questions about, well, okay, we're recognizing this, but what if somebody has a religious objection to it? Are you going to force them to bake the cake, take the wedding photos, or, you know, whatever it happens to be? Is that part of it as well? And so those issues will not be settled by this one case.
Donna Hoffman, what are the implications of the decision that we'll find about out about June?
Well, one of the things that I want to raise in terms of what Kennedy was talking about, this notion of millennia, you know, this definition of marriage that goes back millennia, we have, as Tim pointed out, this notion of evolving standards even there, because back in the millennia, men often had multiple wives in a marriage. That wasn't hit upon in the arguments as much, although Ruth Bader Ginsburg did point out at one point in some of the things that I saw that women were also subservient in marriage.
More or less
the property
of their husbands.
Right, exactly. And so, yes, we have had, you know, this long tradition of marriage, but it even in the sense that Kennedy was talking about, it has evolved. And so that's, you know, that's the question. And so, you know, in terms of the implications of this case, you know, as Tim mentioned, the court can do what the court wants to do. And, you know, they could go relatively far reaching and determine that states, you know, would need to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples. And they could do something a little more narrow in that regard as well. But one of the things to also point out here in terms of the court is that they are sensitive to public opinion. And public opinion on this issue has moved so very quickly that, you know, we now in national polls will have a majority of people saying that they actually do support same-sex marriage. And, you know, there's no really precedent for that in terms of the quickness in which public opinion has changed before on this particular issue. And so the question for the court really comes down to, is this something the court wants to determine for states and make the decision for them? Or is it something that we want to leave to the people, if you will, in the states, in terms of the votes that some states have taken to amend their constitution and those kinds of things? And so I don't know where they're going to come down on that question, but that's, you know, largely what you had in terms of the justices and where they stood. Is this something that we want the court to dictate, or do we want this to be left to the people? And the, you know, Verrilli, who is the Solicitor General, was arguing that if marriage is a fundamental right, then we can't say you can have it in some states and you can't have it in other states. And that's mm-hmm. part of the issue as well.
We've got a couple minutes before the break. Let's squeeze in Shannon calling from Davenport, listening. Shannon, what's on your mind as we talk about the Supreme Court debating this issue?
Very much what your last guest just said, that I think a better comparison is Brown v. Board, where this is not an issue we're still arguing today. It's done. Nobody is still arguing for segregation of schools. It died very quickly. I think gay marriage, the same thing would happen. I don't think this is a Roe v. Wade situation. And I was very kind of dismayed to hear the millennia argument from a Supreme Court justice. That's very much the same as saying tradition. Well, we are the authors of our own traditions. Slavery was traditional. Women, you know, not being equal was tradition. I just find it surprising to hear out of a justice.
Okay. Interestingly enough, thank you very much, Shannon, calling from Davenport. Mara Liasson, in her reporting over the recent days, said there's several reasons why Republicans might cheer a pro-same-sex marriage ruling. Just what you mentioned there, Donna, that public opinion has changed so very quickly here. They just as soon, she says, have it out of the discussion. If it's settled by the Supreme Court, they can say, well, the Supreme Court has spoken. Let's move on to other, perhaps more popular, more divided social issues in public opinion, religious liberty or abortion. She said it could mark a truce in the culture wars of sorts. This same-sex marriage debate has been going on a long time. I guess we'll find out whether that's the case or not. Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa with us. Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa Politics Wednesday. When we come back, we'll talk about a meeting of evangelicals in Waukee, a suburb of Des Moines. They had very special guests this past weekend. 9 declared or likely Republican candidates gathered to speak at the worship hall of the Point of Grace Church in Waukee. And we'll hear some of the words, some of the remarks made by those presidential hopefuls when we come back, and talk about the role of evangelicals in the Iowa caucuses. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support comes from Hertine and Stalker Jewelers, offering...
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, more and more teens are puffing away on electronic cigarettes. Usage has tripled among high school students in just 1 year. Tomorrow on this program, we'll look at how nicotine affects the teenage brain. And even if there's a risk of e-cigarettes, even if the cigarettes contain little or no nicotine. We'll also hear from some of Iowa's most innovative tech companies, winners of the Prometheus Award tomorrow on this program. Today we've been talking about several things, the unrest, the rioting in Baltimore, the political reaction to that, also to the U.S. Supreme Court hearing oral arguments yesterday on the legality of same-sex marriage. Joining us, Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, political scientists joining us from our group of political scientists across the state. To finish up on this, I mentioned before the break, we talked about Mara Liasson and saying this could actually be welcome in a certain sense for Republican hopefuls for the White House. Donna Hoffman, do you think so, that if the Supreme Court rules in favor of same-sex marriage, and does this... in a sense, let the Republicans off the hook, let them focus on other issues?
It does in some ways. I mean, I think mostly what it does is give them some space in which they could say, you know, look, personally, I disagree with this issue, but the Supreme Court has spoken, and, you know, now that's the law of the land, and we have to follow that. That may give them, you know, some segue into how they would make Supreme Court appointments and let them go into other issues. But, you know, it certainly could give them space in which they... because they have, if you've noticed, in terms of the way that they've been talking about this issue, same-sex marriage, they're all against it, but they have different nuances in the way that they talk about, because they don't want to totally turn off young voters who overwhelmingly support this. And so, you know, you get variations of, well, you know, I don't support it, but I would go to a reception. And, you know, I would, if my daughter was gay, that would be okay with me, kinds of things, in which the candidates are trying to, you know, maintain one foot in the I'm against it, and then another foot in the, but, you know, I'm okay with it at certain levels, and they have different variations of that. So a decision that would allow same-sex marriage across all the states would allow them to kind of set that issue aside. They could talk about it as they wanted to, still say they personally disagree with it, you know, and they could move on.
Same-sex marriage, certainly a point of discussion this past weekend on Saturday, when 9 declared or likely Republican candidates gathered to speak at the worship hall of Point of Grace Church in the Des Moines suburb of Waukee, courting the evangelical Christians of that church. The 9 included 2 previous caucus winners, Rick Santorum and Mike Huckabee, as well as newcomers Ted Cruz, Scott Walker, and also other candidates eyeing broader coalitions. Rand Paul, Marco Rubio were there. Let's listen to a few comments from them, have them react. And here's Florida Senator Marco Rubio. He spoke first on Saturday, and he talked about the sanctity of marriage.
We should never have any policies that stand in the way of families. We should never have any policies that stand in the way of marriage. And in this whole debate about the definition of marriage, I remind everyone that marriage as an institution existed before even government itself. That the institution of marriage as one man and one woman existed before our laws existed.
So Donna Hoffman there, Marco Rubio, a young face in the Republican Party, he's certainly courting the evangelical vote there, but does he, as you mentioned a moment ago, perhaps risk turning away younger people, which we know, according to polls, also conservative Christian people more accepting, more tolerant of same-sex marriage?
Well, you know, one of the nuances that Rubio brings to this discussion is that he has said he would go to a same-sex marriage, and also that he doesn't see homosexuality as a choice. So again, trying to stand across that divide that you have in terms of an older generation of Republican voters, and then trying to also appeal to younger voters. And so speaking at it in a nuanced kind of way. And again, all of the candidates are doing that. They're just doing it in kind of different forms. And that's how Rubio has been doing it.
Your comment on the clip we just heard, Tim?
Yeah, I would agree with Donna. The one thing that I would say, though, that's a little bit different take on this is, of course, Republicans often have said, or at least some Republicans said, they want to try to stay away from some of the social issues and maybe focus more on the economic issues, and not just in this cycle, but we heard that even in the last presidential cycle and in 2014 as well, elections. And part of it, at least as far as this issue is concerned, is that it's hard to maybe find what that sweet spot is, so to speak. And not just because the candidates, that they may personally believe this, but because views are changing in the country, that may actually be changing some of their views too. So it's hard to come down on a position that you're going to stick with forever. On the other hand, certainly some people have their beliefs and so forth, and they want to stay with them. The other aspect of this, too, is that this may not be really, even though young people may be in favor generally of same-sex marriage more so than older people, not necessarily a high priority for them. That, again, a lot of at least the students you talk to, is this: am I going to get a job when I get out of college? Am I going to pay for my student loan? And those are of more immediate concern than this other issue.
Talking about the Faith and Freedom Coalition Forum that was held this past Saturday in Waukee, when nine GOP declared and potential presidential candidates spoke before evangelical Christians. Here's another excerpt, this one from Texas Senator Ted Cruz, a declared GOP candidate for the White House in 2016. Here he is talking about the importance of leaders who would stand for what he says are the values our country was founded on.
We need leaders who will stand unapologetically in defense of the Judeo-Christian values America was built on. We need leaders who will stand unapologetically in defense of marriage and life. We need leaders who will stand unapologetically in defense of the First Amendment and the Bill of Rights and the religious liberty of every American.
Donna Hoffman, how do you size up Ted Cruz's appeal to social conservatives here in Iowa?
Well, Cruz really wants, I think, for people to see him as the quote-unquote real conservative. I think in the speech he actually said, you know, what we're looking for in the party is a real conservative, and he wants to make the case that he is that. And I think his view of that is uncompromising. So he used the term there in the clip that you played, unapologetic, but you know, another synonym for that would be uncompromising, in the sense that he really wants to be seen as someone who is principled and will stand on his principles and will not waffle on those. And so he, you know, and he's done that on some other issues as well, where, you know, especially coming into Iowa on the renewable fuel standard, he has taken a similar stance in that, you know, he's going to stand on his principles. And so that's really part of the persona that he wants to put out there.
Okay, who is a Republican candidate who's perhaps softer in those terms that you just described, that is not he would not say was unapologetically? Would that be a Marco Rubio who kind of rounds the sharp corners?
Yeah, because, you know, and especially Rubio on immigration policy and you know, previously what we were talking about in terms of, you know, he doesn't see homosexuality as a choice. And so, yeah, he wants to, and Rand Paul is another one that I think he tries to juxtapose himself with as well, in terms of, I'm the real deal, I'm the real conservative, I'm the one who will, who shares your values, but will also not compromise on those values and take those into the White House. That is what Cruz wants his appeal to be.
Tim Hagel, how important is the evangelical vote to doing well as a Republican in the Iowa caucuses?
Well, like any large segment of the Iowa Republican electorate, it's certainly important. You see studies that get repeated quite often that there are 50%, 57%, I think was actually the figure, and sometimes it gets bumped up to 60% of Iowa Republican caucus goers consider themselves evangelicals. I've always been a little skeptical of that particular figure. It seems rather high to me in terms of it, without seeing the actual phrasing of the question, because if they asked it, well, you know, do you consider yourself a Christian, that kind of a thing, that you're going to get a fairly high number that's going that are going to say yes. But if you say those, you know, is this your main focus? Are you what you would call a evangelical voter or a social conservative voter? Then maybe you may not get quite as high a number, but certainly an important segment. I usually talk about the Republican electors sort of broadly being divided into three groups: the social conservatives, the more libertarian leaning folks, and what you would call the establishment folks, with a lot of crossover among those three. And so it's certainly an important group, and that's why you see a number of the candidates coming to the Faith and Freedom Forum, sort of checking the box, and I don't mean that in a sort of a let's see what way how do I phrase this kind of a light way, that meaning they basically say, look, I have my credentials in social conservatives. But then you get somebody like a Ted Cruz you're just talking about, where he wants to be the one conservative, and the reason is you've got several people that would be considered conservatives, and they're going to be all vying for that same sort of group of base support among the social conservatives. And if the vote is split several ways, then you end up having an establishment candidate be the nominee again, which is something that Ted Cruz and others don't want. And so that's why they have to try to break out from the pack of those that are, again, vying for that social conservative support.
Mm-hmm. Donna, what about the criticism that you hear often that Iowa's caucus goers are so influenced by the evangelical vote that they tend to support candidates that don't have enough national appeal because Iowa's does not reflect the greater United States in that way?
Well, I mean, it's something that you hear quite a bit, but, you know, it is possible within the Iowa Republican caucus structure for other groups to be ascendant. So we could, you know, just go back to 2012 and look at the Liberty faction or the Libertarian wing of the Republican Party did very well in terms of their presence in the caucuses. And how you look at that is to look at how the caucuses elect delegates to go to the next level of convention, until you get to the national GOP convention in 2012. And 22 of the 28 delegates from Iowa cast their ballot for Ron Paul instead of for Mitt Romney. And so the caucuses oftentimes are not very well understood in terms of what they do and what the national media in particular is interested in out of the caucus night, which are the precinct caucuses, is that figure of who won, more or less, which on the Republican side is this, you know, this straw poll. And so given the field this time is so very large and they are vying for very, you know, different key aspects of the party, I think you could have a lot of interesting things happen coming out of the 2016 caucuses, depending on who really catches fire, who might, you know, get people really excited. Will Rand Paul, for example, really be able to hold his father's coalition together in the state and have a decent showing or not? I think there's a whole lot of questions in terms of that, because there may be some libertarians in the state that don't see him as being libertarian enough, because Rand Paul has tried to moderate a little bit on some things. And so, you know, will those people go to Ted Cruz? And so I think you can have an interesting dynamic there. And there can be an overblown quality in terms of talking about how important the evangelical vote is in the state. It certainly is important, but there's other pockets of that coalition that can be important and could be ascendant as well, depending on if they catch fire or not.
Okay. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Politics Wednesday. Donna Hoffman is with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Let's talk about a couple of other things before this hour gets away from us. On Sunday, the Clinton Foundation's acting chief executive admitted that the charity had made mistakes on how it listed government donors on its tax returns. It said it was working to make sure it does not happen in the future. This nonprofit foundation and its list of donors have been under some scrutiny in recent weeks. Republicans, the critics in the Republican ranks say the foundation makes Hillary Clinton vulnerable due to undue influence. Tim Hagel, do you think this controversy is likely to have legs and damage the candidacy?
Well, as always, that remains to be seen. It's certainly getting a lot of attention right now, and the book that a lot of this recent criticism is based on is coming out next week, and so we'll see if it has anything more, although the author has indicated that he doesn't have any direct evidence of anything, shall we say, illegal going on. He would suggest that the patterns that we're seeing suggest that maybe things were going on that were inappropriate in one way or another, and it's something that folks really want to take a look at, and although this author, is, the Clinton campaign has noted very vociferously had been a Bush supporter in the past. He has written other books that have gone after big government, big spending, and sort of the nexus between these sort of corporations and lobbying and all of that. So this is nothing new for him, and he's apparently in the works writing a book on Jeb Bush along the same line. So we'll see when that's coming out, if it does anytime soon. But basically, you have to have some sort of a connection, because Clinton organization will be very good at saying, oh, look, this is old news, or that we've seen this story before. And although I hadn't heard the phrase yet, but the old vast right-wing conspiracy idea that this is just more of the same. And so in that sense, they'll try to dismiss it, saying that, you know, there's no evidence of this, which is not a particularly strong denial, saying as opposed to we didn't do it. But on the other hand, just because there's a lot going on here, and it's not, as I heard a few reporters say, this is not something that can fit on a bumper sticker. We'll have to see the tolerance of the public for a more complicated story like this.
Mm-hmm. Donna Hoffman, what do you see through the fog surrounding this Clinton Foundation controversy?
Well, you know, I mean, at one level, there's not a whole lot of people who are undecided on Hillary Clinton. You know, you like her or you don't like her. And these kinds of revelations that we're going to have, you know, I think throughout the campaign season, especially in regards to Hillary Clinton, are things that are going to be viewed through a partisan lens. And so both sides of the partisan debate in terms of this particular book and this particular issue have weighed in terms of, you know, where they think they are. And, you know, at this stage of the game, I don't see a whole lot of people being persuaded by that. People who were supporting Hillary Clinton just based on that are not going to say, yeah, you're right, I'm not going to vote for Hillary. In fact, I'm going to vote for a Republican. That there's not a whole lot of people who are in that camp. Who are paying attention to politics. Now, when we get to the general election and you have the independent voters coming in, then you have, you know, some more people who are a little bit more lacking in terms of their political information. But, you know, this kind of is the narrative that's been constructed around Hillary Clinton. She's a little bit vulnerable in terms of transparency or lack thereof. And this is an issue that's continually going to come back. We have the Benghazi hearings that are coming back based on the email. We have this book coming out. And so it's kind of a continual drumbeat that I think you're going to hear for most of the campaign.
Mm-hmm. And finally, we want to end this on a lighter note. I want to get to you. You are political junkies. Of course, you've chosen politics as your career, analysis of it, Donna and Tim. Donna, do you watch the White House Correspondents' Dinner?
I don't watch it when it happens, but I watch, you know, snippets of it after. So I have watched the high points of it. And I watched all of President Obama's speech, which I think was you know, quite frankly, one of the high points from everything I've gathered, and because his remarks were fairly lengthy and they were fairly humorous. And you know, this is an opportunity for a president to go before an audience they, you know, may not necessarily have really all that great relationships with, the press, and poke fun at themselves. And that's the presidential tradition. And Obama did that.
Okay. And let's listen to President Obama with what all acknowledge is one of the highlights of his talk there, really also tackling with humor some of the most controversial aspects of his presidency at the White House Correspondents' Dinner over the weekend. Obama joking about his bucket list before the end of his presidency.
After the midterm elections, my advisors asked me, Mr. President, do you have a bucket list? And I said, well, I have something that rhymes with bucket list. Take executive action on immigration? Bucket. New climate regulations? Bucket. It's the right thing to do.
Okay, President Obama there joking. Jokes aside, Tim Hagel, do you hear in this, talking about executive action, some truth that politicians can't really say here? I mean, we could imagine that humor has some basis in truth.
Well, that's often the best humor that has some basis in truth. And a lot of times you'll see that in these, whether it's this one, I didn't see more than a snippet or two of this one, but in past years where some of the best jokes and the jokes that get often somewhat nervous laughter is when they strike a little too close to home because they have that grain of truth to them. Now, whether it crosses the line over something that's funny or oops, kind of an oops moment,
right,
is often in the eye of the beholder.
Let's listen to one other clip before the hour ends here. This one, less played that we've heard over than the bucket list comment there. This is President Obama responding to some of his critics and notably taking a shot at former U.S. Congresswoman and now and also Iowa native, native of Waterloo, Michelle Bachmann, taking her to task for comments she'd made early last week.
It gets worse. Just this week, Michelle Bachmann actually predicted that I would bring about the biblical end of days. Now, that's a legacy. That's big. I mean, Lincoln, Washington, they didn't do that.
Donna Hoffman, that moment, good for a few laughs there. What else stuck out to you about the White House Correspondents' Dinner?
Yeah, good for a few laughs, and you know, I think it also helps the president, laugh some of those things off as well. You know, one of the things that was significant in the speech was his anger translator that came in.
Yes,
and you know, so he could through that person give voice to things that he might want to react to, but couldn't because they were presidential. That was pretty funny, but you know, it is inherently frustrating to be president. You know, going back to the bucket list thing. You know, as you campaign for the presidency by telling the American public all the things that you're going to do. But the reality is that when you become president, you can't do a lot of those things unless Congress goes along with you. And so this is a way for a president to kind of take some of those frustrations, especially at this particular point in your presidency, because there's no more elections for Obama.
Right.
And you're a little bit freer, and maybe you can be a little bit funnier with your jokes at the Correspondents' Dinner.
So you're saying it does serve a purpose aside from a night of comedy?
You know, I think it does. It kind of humanizes the president, and especially with the press corps. I mean, the press corps has been particularly critical of Obama in not meeting with them as much as they would like. And he, you know, he took aim at that, too, because one of the things that, you know, he talked about was, you know, people say I'm aloof and I'm you know, standoffish. And, you know, he said, oh, people are so stupid. That's why I don't talk to him. And so, you know, he again, pokes fun at himself in front of this audience and you know, reminds people of you know, some of the larger truths that might be out there that, yeah, some of these things that get, you know, pointed at me may in fact be rather crazy, but in a normal forum, I can't say that, but here I can say that.
Okay. Thank you very much. Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, our analysts for this Politics Wednesday. Tim, Donna, thank you very much for coming in today.
Welcome.
Thanks, Ben.
Tomorrow on the program, we'll talk about e-cigarettes. The usage among high school students has tripled in just 1 year. We'll also hear tomorrow about from winners of the Prometheus Award, some of Iowa's most innovative tech companies. In Cedar Falls, we had help today from Tony Daner. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Also, thanks to Julia Davis. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.